I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Sustainability is the new imperative for urban leaders, and now there's a new way to encourage and even measure a community's sustainability. It's called Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design for Neighborhood Development, LEED-ND for short, and it extends criteria for green building to neighborhoods. Jennifer Henry from the U.S. Green Building Council is with us to talk about the new guidelines and the impact they will have on cities. Also with us is Helen Mulligan, who's been exploring ways that cities, particularly older industrial cities around the world, can take advantage of the growing interest in green technologies to fuel local economic development. Our subject is the greening of cities, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jennifer Henry is based at the U.S. Green Building Council in Washington. The organization that brought us the LEED rating system that tells us whether our buildings are environmentally sensitive is now bringing us a new rating system that will tell us the same thing about our neighborhoods. Jennifer worked with the Natural Resources Defense Council on legislation for New Jersey that would establish a tax credit for smart growth developments and has also worked with the Trust for Public Land and Madison Metro Bus Transit. Jennifer, explain LEED.
LEED is a rating system for green buildings. It's been a rating system to help mark a building that's gone through a rather rigorous certification process and met certain standards in various categories. And the LEED rating system has been for buildings in the past. LEED for Neighborhood Development is the rating system that I've been working to develop, and it brings LEED sort of beyond the buildings to the community scale.
Explain some of the standards that a building must meet to attain LEED status.
Sure. There's five categories of credits and prerequisites. So each project has to meet all of the prerequisites and then a certain number of credits. The categories are energy and atmosphere. So that's the energy efficiency of the building, whether it uses renewable sources for energy, whether it buys green power from green power companies, things like that. Water efficiency, that's indoor and outdoor water efficiency, landscaping, plumbing fixtures, things like that. Materials and resources, so recycled content, recyclability of the content, whether it has toxic content that off-gasses, things like that. And then, sustainable sites, that has to do with the landscaping around the building as well as the location of the building in relation to transportation, public transit or other urban areas, things like that, density of the location. And then finally, there's indoor environmental quality, which is largely air quality and then daylighting and views.
How many LEED status buildings do we now have in the U.S.?
We have over 700 certified buildings. So those are the buildings that have gone through and been verified as certified. We have over 5,000 buildings that have registered their intent to certify.
And so, huge pickup. How long has the LEED rating been around?
We're about to have a little party to celebrate its seventh birthday, actually. But you have to understand, at the very beginning, it was, no one had heard of it. We only had a few buildings in our original pilot program. When I started working at U.S. Green Building Council 3 years ago, we were excited about getting to 90 certified buildings. And then in the last 3 years, we've, just been going up exponentially. And we're up to in the 700s now.
To what do you attribute the real exponential growth?
A lot of factors. I think the market, in some ways, the market was ready for it. There were a lot of people out there that knew something about green, that wanted to do green, and wanted to be able to differentiate themselves in a very real and measurable way, rather than just have everyone who banned smoking in their buildings call themselves a green building. So there was a real need for it. I think U.S. Green Building Council, as an environmental nonprofit, is really different from a lot of others in that it gives the people on the ground a tool that says we've done this and it's enough that we can say we've really marked ourselves as different. And a lot of other programs give guidelines, such as, try to be more energy efficient, and it's hard to sort of know when you've done enough. And of course, you've never done enough, but you've done enough for LEED certification if you've, reduced your energy consumption by 30%. And that's something that people who are not natural environmentalists can really grab onto and say, great, I know how to do that, rather than spend a lot of time philosophizing about, you know, what's the most environmental thing to do.
And now you're attempting to extend the concept of LEED status beyond single buildings or clusters of buildings to neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. From a homeowner's point of view, how will living in a neighborhood that meets LEED standards differ from living in a neighborhood that doesn't?
In general, I think most of the homes would be more energy efficient. They would be more water efficient. They'd have all those qualities of the green building that you have in the LEED certifications. That's not a guarantee just because of the way the rating system works. It's flexible. Not every project's going to be the same. But I think that's part of it. I think the real thing that you'll see is that those neighborhoods will be more walkable. They'll be located near existing areas so that there'll be amenities, shops, and services. There might be transit available. There would be the possibility of biking, walking, or taking transit and not being entirely dependent on the car. And that can be beneficial in a number of ways. Public health, it enables you and your children to walk around more. It can reduce your transportation budget quite considerably. You might be able to reduce yourself from a 3-car household to a 2-car household and save all of the insurance and parking and gas and maintenance fees, as well as the cost of the car itself. And I think that they're going to be more community-oriented neighborhoods. I think that people will have a better chance to interact with their neighbors in a positive way.
Are there big categories of standards that a LEED certified neighborhood must meet, just as there are with a LEED building?
Yeah, there are, in fact, and they're different. There's 3 categories. The first category is called smart location and linkage, and that's sort of that first level of decision-making that a developer makes in terms of selecting the site itself. So it encourages the credits in that category encourage locating near existing urban areas, locating near transportation infrastructure, locating not on wetlands and other critical habitat and environmentally sensitive areas, and sort of making that first decision of where a building goes, which has incredible impacts on the environment, habitat, atmosphere, carbon, climate change, all of those things are impacted by where development is built. The second category is called neighborhood pattern and design. And so after you've picked your site on the map, how are you going to lay out your streets? How are you going to build your buildings in relation to each other? How compact is it going to be? How many stories are your buildings going to be? Are you going to have little pocket parks? Things like that. That's what's encouraged in that second category. And then finally, the third category is called green construction and technology. And that encapsulates basically all of those other green building categories in it, as well as some sort of more green infrastructure things, whether the streets themselves are made out of recycled content, as well as the materials in the buildings.
The U.S. Green Building Council helped develop the new standards. Who were your partners?
The Congress for New Urbanism and the Natural Resources Defense Council. The Natural Resources Defense Council Smart Growth Program really was the agent within that organization, and they brought in a number of other smart growth advocacy organizations. And each organization contributed experts to a committee that helped develop the rating system.
What were the issues that you argued over the most?
Oh, there were so many. It's hard to choose just one. I think, one of the real big issues is obviously, which locations should be able to be certified and which shouldn't. You can do a project that has a really good street grid in a terrible location, and you can do vice versa as well. So whether or not every location was going to be able to be potentially certified was a big issue that we wrestled with.
You mentioned smart location and linkage as really a topic of controversy within the committee. And I'm wondering, who do you expect to apply for LEED certification in terms of this new neighborhood development? And do you expect older neighborhoods, ones that in fact are built in very smart locations, on transit, nearby, all the linkages are clear, but they're already built?
Sure.
Do you expect to get action from those neighborhoods? And if so, who would initiate it?
Yeah, great questions. The primary market that we have are our developers, the folks who are going to be building new housing and commercial construction anyway. We want to try to get them to think of doing it in different ways, in different places, with different technologies. So that's the primary market, is the developers of new developments. We don't actually have a maximum or a minimum size on what a pilot project could be for our pilot program. We might at some point, but for right now, it's really open to all different sizes of projects, different types. It can be single use or mixed use. The idea is a neighborhood can, you know, a neighborhood development project could be a fraction of a neighborhood, a whole neighborhood, or multiple neighborhoods. You can have a project that's completing an existing neighborhood that is worthy of recognition, as well as something that constitutes a whole neighborhood. In terms of your second question about older cities and neighborhoods that are incredibly location efficient and walkable and great, I've heard rumors that there are actually some neighborhoods that are thinking of trying to apply for our pilot program and be certified. The rating system was definitely not designed for that. I think some of the credits would be a difficult fit. And ideally, I mean, although I think those communities are worth recognizing, so I don't think we'll necessarily preclude them from participating, I think it would be difficult to get the sort of entity. It would have to be something like a neighborhood association or a community development corporation, something that could sort of act as the agent for the neighborhood to go through and document all of the credits and the prerequisites, which is much easier for a developer to do from the get-go than to sort of do retroactively after the fact. I think that also for those neighborhoods that have been in existence for 100 years, you know, if they want to green themselves and they want to be recognized for that, there are a different set of issues that they could address. They can address sort of operational and maintenance issues rather than design issues, which is this, what most of the rating system gets at.
I'm curious if you discussed at all the potential for an unintended consequence. You say developers are your market. That makes sense. Developers of new construction, new neighborhoods. That makes sense. That's a robust market. However, if the rating becomes a marketing advantage, and in so becoming creates a disadvantage, a marketing disadvantage for in-town neighborhoods, shall we say, older neighborhoods, again, well-located, well-linked neighborhoods with great neighborhood pattern and design, then do you create, as I say, an unintended consequence to say living, you know, in new neighborhoods, perhaps beyond the what is developed today, is more desirable from an environmental standpoint than is living in older neighborhoods? I'm just curious if you had that discussion.
You know, we haven't really had that discussion. I don't think that anyone has yet and worried too much about a new LEED for Neighborhood Development certified project taking away from the market demand for, you know, really great neighborhoods in urban areas like Georgetown or Brooklyn Heights or, you know, places in other cities. I think what we've, you know, the reason that housing prices are so high in San Francisco and New York and D.C. and other places is that there is a huge demand for walkable neighborhoods and transit-oriented development. And I think that it'll be a long time before, because we've been undersupplying that market for so long by building lower density, totally auto-dependent types of residential development in the suburbs, we've been undersupplying that market for walkable and transit-oriented. And I think it'll be a long time before there'll be so much of it that you'll see an impact in an older neighborhood that's already achieved its sort of, you know, cachet and reputation as a great place to live.
But as you know, Jennifer, there are many in-town neighborhoods, city neighborhoods, that in fact have not yet quite achieved the cachet of a Georgetown or a
Sure.
Brooklyn Heights, that are transitional, that where you're beginning to see momentum. Did you think about, or have you thought about, can you imagine in your future providing some sort of certification for those neighborhoods that where you take into account the fact that they are already constructed, they exist, but there are things that could be done to make them more marketable from by giving them a badge of honor, if you will, from a sustainability standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly possible that we would in the future develop some form of recognition for that. In the meantime, I think that, you know, most of those places that are transitional are still suffering from some aspect of economic decline in one way or the other. And I think the great thing about Lead for Neighborhood Developments is that because it could be targeted at just a very small infill project, you know, you could take some of those vacant lots in those cities that are transitional and bring some breathe some new life into them and help the neighboring areas that are still there but are suffering and are not in as high of demand as Brooklyn Heights, and really bring the whole community back together instead of it doesn't have to be the entire neighborhood that is Lead for Neighborhood certified in order to reap some of the benefits of it.
Very good point. You've referred a couple of times to the pilot. Give me the timetable for Lead ND, Lead Neighborhood Developments. You've invited applications to participate in the pilot.
April 6th is the deadline for turning in an application for being in the pilot. The application is just a couple of quick forms for projects that are interested. And then over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be working with the Lead for Neighborhood Development Committee to select up to 120 projects that would be our pilot projects. So then the pilot itself will run for between 9 and 15 months. It's a little bit fluid what the actual timeline on that is. It basically, we'll start winding down the pilot once we feel like we've gained enough experience from the pilot itself. And so the pilot will be when these projects actually go through the rating system and document themselves against the credits and prerequisites as they do in other LEED rating systems when they get certified. So once we've gotten enough input and feedback from those pilot projects, we'll start winding the pilot program down and we'll start revising the rating system based on the lessons we've learned during the pilot, and then proceed with our approval process for the rating system to have a fully launched rating system that's available for everyone.
What was the impetus for this expansion of LEED?
There were a couple different, I think. I think from the U.S. Green Building Council's perspective, you know, that we know that not all development happens one building at a time. So to have a tool that can leverage change at multiple buildings scale was certainly part of it. From the smart growth and new urbanist perspective, it was a need to have a similar tool to really recognize and thereby encourage projects to do smart growth and new urbanism, and to do enough of it that it's worth calling, you know, by a particular name, a certified name. So all three partners had sort of slightly different but convergent desires to bring this project into being.
Is it easier for a developer to do a LEED ND certified neighborhood if the public policy in the metro area in which he or she is developing encourages it? I'm trying to understand the intersection of public policy with the LEED ND certification.
It's similar in a lot of ways, but it is a little bit different because we're trying to leverage those location decisions and those sort of an earlier set of decisions than the HVAC system in the building. That decision comes into play. We're trying to give a conditional approval available. It's not called a certification, but it would be a letter of approval that developers could get really early on, even before they get their entitlements, as they're going through that process of trying to get the local land use authorities, planning commissions, and things on board. So whether local governments sort of adopt incentives for LEED or not is sort of – that's always been a grassroots thing, and people see LEED as a tool that they can use. Our idea is that even if there's no formal adoption, local governments will get to the point where they're aware enough of LEED for Neighborhood Developments that they see it as a seal of good housekeeping, if you will. And if a project team walks through the door and says, we want to build – you know, this project in your community and it's going to be LEED for Neighborhood Development and we have this letter that shows they've already looked at our plans, and it is that a local government would look more favorably on that, and it would help them build their case. And in that way, it would help to save the developer time and therefore money and serve as an incentive for the developer to try to do LEED for Neighborhood Development.
Well, that would be a huge financial incentive to be able to speed up development, wouldn't it?
That's what we're hoping, yes.
What impact do you hope LEED ND will have on our cities?
We hope that we will make our cities more livable and more environmentally friendly, and make the way we live our lives from day to day and go to school and work more efficient and environmentally, have less of an impact on habitat, the atmosphere, the water receiving bodies, all of that.
Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure. Thank you.
Jennifer Henry helped develop the new LEED ND rating system for the U.S. Green Building Council. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planet as an assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Pumping biodiesel in their trucks and lighting their stores up with fluorescent bulbs makes Walmart green, right? Well, not as long as people keep driving there. As big box retailers like Walmart and Target have seen explosive growth over the last 15 years, the amount of miles Americans drive to run errands has shown a similar rise. An article from Grist looks at how the trend towards suburbanization has resulted in more people having to drive farther from their homes to get to the services they need. And while sprawling development can be partly blamed for the increasing distances many have to travel, the article argues that big box retailers should also be blamed for edging out smaller businesses and locating themselves on the fringes of cities and suburbs. So even with environmentally friendly practices, big box retail won't ever be truly sustainable if it keeps locating farther from its customers and putting local businesses out of business. Another correlation being seen across the US and Europe is the relationship between home ownership and high levels of unemployment. Slate magazine reports that a new study has shown that of all the perceived causes of unemployment, it is home ownership that offers the best explanation for higher unemployment rates. The study shows that areas with the highest unemployment rates are also those with the highest rates of home ownership, a trend most likely caused by the unwillingness of invested homeowners to pick up and move just because they lost their job. Economists say that to work against this trend, governments should put more effort into lifting the barriers to selling homes and encouraging more people to rent. And finally, it seems things are turning around for New Orleans. In fact, they're turning so far around, they've practically gone back in time. Satellite imagery of the city, accessible on the website Google Maps, shows a vibrant, prosperous, and oddly undevastated New Orleans. The images now on display on the site were taken before the hurricanes of 2005, causing many to wonder why Google is showing images so far out of date and so misleadingly inaccurate. According to the Associated Press, the company claims that the images are the best they have available, but many residents who supplemented their insurance claims with Google's previously displayed images of the more current situation are leery of the website's intentions. Covert conspiracy or not, the images may change the way the city looks online, but not the way it looks on the ground. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Helen Mulligan about how to use green technologies for economic development in shrinking cities. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. Dr. Helen Mulligan is director of Cambridge Architectural Research Limited. Her special expertise is in energy use and thermal design, with particular emphasis on sustainable systems. Her book, The New Californian Architecture, Resource Efficiency for the 21st Century, is shortly to be published by Taylor & Francis. She's an active member of the Shrinking Cities Group and is collaborating on a multi-author global study of issues associated with urban shrinkage. Link for me, Helen, the concepts of sustainability and shrinking cities.
Okay. Sustainability covers a very wide area. What I'm particularly interested in is environmental sustainability, which links with the other aspects, primarily economic sustainability and social equity. But what I'm looking at is the whole field of environmental issues, which encompasses resource depletion from the use of land, the use of water, the use of energy resources, and the control of emissions, which, as you know, are damaging the ozone layer and also the Earth's capacity to maintain its thermal equilibrium. So I'm looking at this in relation to those cities that are losing population and are also showing some symptoms of economic crisis. My interest is in looking at how some cities seem to be using concepts of sustainability as a kind of catalyst for change, so they can look at their change circumstances and say, well, what positive can we make out of this? What kind of new future can we see for ourselves with perhaps a different economic basis or a different level in terms of quality of life? So using the fact that they are reducing in population actually to give their citizens a more pleasant environment, a more livable city in many ways.
Are shrinking cities capable of taking a concept like environmental sustainability and asking that question, what positive can we make of this? What opportunity is nested in this idea of sustainability for our city?
Well, they certainly do. There are very many cities, for example, that are part of the network founded by the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, which is based here in Berkeley. They call themselves Cities for a Sustainable Future. There are over 500 of them spread around the world in more than 60 countries. And they're working on a whole raft of different initiatives to improve the sustainability in environmental terms of their cities. And we know that very many of those are, in fact, shrinking cities. Of the 100 cities that are shrinking most rapidly in the world, almost a third of those are part of the Cities for the Sustainable Future network.
When you think about those 100 cities, other than the fact they're shrinking, do you see other characteristics in common?
When you look at the cities that are taking initiatives in the sustainability field, they do have some characteristics in common. They tend to be cities that have a very proud heritage, a great stock of wonderful architecture, for example. They are the cities that are likely to attract tourism in the future. They're centers of culture. And it seems to be that it's those cities that have very many linked possibilities that are also emphasizing these livability and sustainability aspects of their environment.
I was talking with a guest recently, Scott Sanders, who wrote, I thought, a beautiful speech on the idea of civic tourism. And of course, he was challenging the conventional tourism as simply a shopping opportunity. It's a long-distance shopping opportunity for a typical tourist. And he was challenging his audience in this case to affect a more civic, a more sustainable brand of tourism, and one that is a contributor to distinctive places rather than a shopping experience or a consumption experience. And I'm curious about cities that are thinking about building sustainability strategies, either, as you say, for economic reasons or for quality of life reasons, or perhaps both. How did they think about tourism within a sustainability paradigm?
Well, there are a number of cities that are very explicit about linking the two, and one of those is San Francisco. In 1999, San Francisco established, as part of its sustainability strategy, a Green Buildings Initiative, and they selected 10 projects which would be showcases for environmental concepts in building, and they particularly selected very high-profile projects that would be places that will be visited by visitors to San Francisco, And act as a kind of reference for them when they return to the places that they might have traveled from, to kind of disseminate the concepts. One of those projects you might know is the Moscone Convention Center in downtown San Francisco, and another is the rebuilding of the California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park, which is a great kind of infotainment complex with an aquarium, a planetarium. It's the kind of place where school kids come in groups or with their parents to learn about the natural environment. And that's going to be a terrific showcase for green ideas.
Do you think, you mentioned several characteristics that cities have in common that happen to be shrinking cities as well as cities pursuing sustainability strategies. And you mentioned proud heritage, great architecture, tourism, centers of culture. Is there some ethos that envelops or provides the context for interest in those aspects or characteristics that of proud heritage and centers of culture and sustainability? Do they come from the same place, those impulses?
I think they come from slightly different places, but they come together in a kind of nexus of self-reinforcing ideas. Perhaps I should give you some examples from the among the cities that are shrinking most rapidly in the world that are taking this kind of approach. One of those is, for example, Copenhagen, the capital of Denmark. That's certainly in the top 25 shrinking cities, but it's leveraging its heritage in this kind of way. Another is Glasgow in the UK. That's losing its economic base in shipbuilding, iron and steel, and is reinventing itself as a city of culture. And there are a number of cities in northern Italy, for example, Turin, Bologna. Similarly, deindustrialization process is taking place. They're turning towards services for a new economy, but with a smaller population base, and they see the possibilities of taking their, you know, the magnificent medieval architecture of Bologna, the towers in that city, and making them a focus for this new image.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned first Copenhagen. Because that's a city that you say is one of the top 25 shrinking cities in the world, and yet I think almost no one would hang that reputation on that city. No one would criticize Copenhagen as a declining city. How do you think they've been able to manage shrinkage so gracefully?
That's a large question. I think part of it is the fact that they have been shrinking over quite a long period of time. So they have been able to adapt and to put in place strategies to, as you say, to manage that gracefully. The cities that have started to shrink in the quite recent past are perhaps still in a state of shock. They haven't quite come to terms with it. They haven't really got those strategies in place to address it. I'm thinking there particularly of the large cities in the countries that were part of the Soviet Union and are suffering a very dramatic transformation into a new economic paradigm. The capitals, for example, of the Baltic states, Riga, Vilnius, Tallinn, the big cities in the Ukraine, cities in the Central Asian republics are in that state. They are shrinking rapidly, but they haven't, in the main, I believe Riga is an exception, they're not really taking environmental strategies to address their issues.
Ellen, do you work directly with the cities for a sustainable future?
No, I'm in contact with them, but I don't work directly with them.
Are cities beginning to identify now best practices in this area, common strategies, things that they all should be doing, and are they learning from one another? Is a formula developing, or are we still too new at this to have the formula in place?
I think we're quite early in the field. As you may know, in the building world and very much in the planning world, it takes a very long time to see a project through from conception to completion. So the political process begins, the involvement of the stakeholders begins, the policy is put in place, it's enacted through whatever municipal ordinances or whatever may be appropriate. Then the implementation phase comes, and that can take several years for important projects. And it's not until maybe, 10 or even 20 years down the line that you can really see what the results are and begin to step back and assess that. So it seems to me at the moment what's happening is that many cities are at the beginning of that process. They have the policies in place. They have the ideas of what they want to do. Some of them who are ahead of the curve are in the implementation phase now. Very few of them are actually at the stage where it's been in operation for long enough to be assessed in any realistic way.
Mm-hmm. You say it may be too early for benchmarks, but I know it's not too early for measurement, and you've been thinking about how to do that, indicators of sustainability.
That's right. That's right. There are quite a few initiatives in this field. There's nothing like a kind of international basis for assessment at the moment. But we in the Shrinking Cities International Network are looking to put that together by dialogue between the countries that are involved in that network. I'm hoping to extend it outwards.
And you talk about the Shrinking Cities Network. Tell me about that network. Who's part of it, and why does it exist?
It came together as a group of scholars, academics and others, practitioners in the planning field, who are interested in the issues of shrinking cities. You may know the interest in Europe has been going on in quite a strong way for a number of years. There is some interest in the U.S. and certainly in other countries such as Japan, which sees a very big demographic change coming, a dropping population and a reduction very strongly in the working age population. They are very interested. Other Asian countries like South Korea, a number of Latin American countries are also involved in the network, in Mexico and Brazil and so on. So we're trying to bring together experiences from a number of different parts of the world and making comparisons and looking for joint approaches.
And across that Shrinking Cities Network, are you finding an interest in sustainability and how, again, it can either generate economic opportunity or increase livability, or I would assume also improved identity?
All three of those are important, yes, and certainly a number of cities that we have studied in some detail are putting this kind of strategy in place. My colleague Karina Pelax, for example, has carried out a study of Youngstown, Ohio, which is very strongly moving in this direction.
Yes, in fact, I talked to the mayor of Youngstown recently, Jay Williams, very sharp mayor, very mm-hmm. young mayor
right.
of Youngstown, Ohio, and was very impressed by the way he had embraced mm-hmm. the reality that Youngstown is shrinking and is determined now to operate off that reality in a positive way. Very, very interesting to see. I'm wondering, Helen, do you find that interest in sustainability is simply more likely or more appropriate to mature, developed, maybe even shrinking cities?
I think that there's interest in sustainability and very appealing opportunities, both in new development and in looking to leverage an existing situation. From the point of view of buildings, it's much more cost-effective to build in those sorts of measures right from the start. Mm-hmm. So in situations like that of the large cities in China, there's a great deal of interest in sustainable opportunities, a very, very big chance to improve the quality of the building stock in this regard because the turnover is so rapid. There are other situations of cities that are older, that are shrinking, where most of the construction activity is in remodeling rather than in new build, where there are perhaps more challenging and trickier issues to be addressed here, but ones that are certainly still of interest and can be very beneficial.
I was interested to see comments by the head of planning in India who was insisting at Davos that developing countries certainly have the right to assert essentially the same per capita pollution, if you will, as developed countries. And, of course, we know that because of the number of people in China and India, as those countries develop, as they acquire cars, as they increase car use for mobility, as they build more, then you have a situation that could increase carbon emissions. I'm curious how you see that tension unfolding over the next 5-10 years.
Well, developing countries such as India and China certainly from an internal point of view, if you like, are very committed to improving the efficiency of what they do and simply improving the value for money of what they get. So they are putting in place quite strong controls in areas where, in some cases, there haven't been any in the past. For example, until last year, the fall of 2005, China had no thermal regulations for commercial buildings apart from hotels. Those are now in place and they're quite rigorous. There will be another issue of actually certification of that kind of measure, but that's certainly where the policy is going. And that's where the governments of those countries know that they have to move. From the point of view of the stance they take on the international stage, that's a slightly different issue. We're at the beginning of quite a long game there, I believe. We are still a long way from an international trading system in emission permits, as you're probably aware. There's a system which has now been running for more than a year within the European Union member states, which is certainly providing a framework for reductions. The framework is what it is at the moment, but certainly we're going to be moving forward to a situation in which reduction of greenhouse gas emissions under this mandatory framework is going to bite quite severely. As you know, the United States is not involved in that kind of a process at the moment, but there's a great deal of discussion on a bilateral basis between the US and states such as China and India. So I see a post-Kyoto trading framework, if you like, becoming a reality in the future. The timescale is not as yet certain, and the shape of the relationships as yet is not certain. But the intentionality is there, and I believe that is the direction in which progress is going to be made.
I noticed that LEED standards for neighborhoods, similar to LEED standards for building, are now being tested in the U.S. And it seems that could have particular relevance to shrinking cities, not only at a neighborhood level, but how all of those neighborhoods are spread across the landscape. How do you see shrinking cities dealing with the fact that they perhaps have more land than they need to have to now service the populations they have, and how they think about shrinking the land surface or the service area in proportion to the shrinking population?
That's a very good question. A lot of shrinking cities are grappling with these problems. And in some cases, for example, in Japan, this kind of problem is leading to the bankruptcy of municipalities. They simply cannot afford to maintain services over the large area that they historically have with a smaller population. It's a tough one to deal with. You may know the experience in the cities of Eastern Germany has been that a very large amount of money has been made available for demolition of housing units, for example, that are superfluous to the requirements of the population. A similar policy in the United Kingdom is very quietly taking place too. Regeneration grants are essentially being dedicated to what's called land assembly. That means paying developers essentially to buy out house owners in areas where there is little housing demand so that wide-scale demolition can take place and regeneration options can then be assessed. It's an extremely tricky area. It's a very expensive area. And it's an area in which municipalities, I think quite rightly, need to look to their regional or national bodies for assistance.
Helen, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
Dr. Helen Mulligan is a member of the Shrinking Cities Group and director of Cambridge Architectural Research Limited. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Young people are driving many of today's changes in technology and its uses. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says we shouldn't be surprised.
Youth is no impediment to leadership and inspiration. Throughout history, teenagers have distinguished themselves by stepping up to meet the challenges and responsibilities of stressful and demanding situations. At 14, Richard II put down a rebellion. Rossini conducted an orchestra at that age, and Alexander Hamilton drew up trading rules for the firm that employed him. At 14, Catherine de' Medici was married to the 14-year-old Duke d'Orléans, who later ruled France as Henry II. In this country in recent decades, successive generations of young people have led pioneering social changes. The parents of baby boomers gave up a large part of their youthful years and numbers to fight fascist aggressors. Baby boomers were the shock troops manning the barricades and protest movements to extend civil rights, to end the war in Vietnam, and to protect the environment. Generation X grew up to be the dot-com entrepreneurs who ushered in the internet boom. In every case, older generations took their lead from the guidance and innovation of younger generations. Tragedies inflicted on children have often been instrumental in motivating us to undertake much-needed, often long-overdue changes for the better. The four little girls killed by the 1963 Birmingham church bombing horrified the nation and helped to hasten the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Mothers Against Drunk Driving was founded in 1980 by a group of mothers in California led by Candy Leitner, whose teenage daughter had been killed by a drunk driver. The passage of Megan's Law to register sex offenders grew out of the rape and murder of 7-year-old Megan Kanka by a neighbor who was a twice-convicted sex offender. Athletes in many sports, scientists in many disciplines, and performers in certain genres are well past their primes by the time they reach their late 20s. Child prodigies like Mozart, Bobby Fischer, and Itzhak Perlman are rare, but are no less influential or admired because of the young age at which they achieved their successes and produced memorable work. We think of youth as our hope for the future, but in many instances, youth is our best hope for today as well. Yet where in our communities do we create a place for the leadership and inspiration of our youth? College campuses are one such place, of course. Boycotts and protests led by college students have made a difference over the years in battles against apartheid and the exploitation of third world labor. But other than college campuses, there is a dearth of places where young people can be taken seriously and can find opportunities to make a difference. Young people get more respect and attention from marketers than they get from most community leaders. Marketers know that young people have enormous buying power, controlling the expenditure of hundreds of billions of dollars, both for their own consumption and as decision makers for their households. Marketers target people who make decisions about how to spend money, which more and more is what parents have empowered their children with the authority and wherewithal to do. Young people have more to offer our communities and our society, though, than just protesting and consuming. Indeed, they have a unique perspective on where we are today and on where we are headed in the future. Today's teenagers are growing up amidst a multiculturalism of difference and diversity that is unprecedented in American history. They are facile with technology and adept at new forms of technologically facilitated communities that are variously described as thumb tribes for the ways people type out text messages or smart mobs for the ways people move in concert with wireless devices. Today's teenagers have come of age with the extremes of entertainment, the stock market, celebrity, irony, paradox, and terrorism. Today's teenagers have a distinctive worldview. Young people today understand many important things intuitively that adults will never be able to grasp and fully absorb. Certain skills and expertise must be wired into your makeup at an early age in order for you to truly master them. With the world of tomorrow already upon us today, the perspective and contributions of youth are that much more important to our own success and survival, and that much more crucial for our communities to recognize and support. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.